At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is Michael Erard, who was trained as a linguist and historian. He spent more than two decades sharing compelling stories about language and languages and the people who use and study them. His latest book, Bye Bye, I Love You, The Story of Our First and Last Words, is a beautiful and intimate exploration of first and last words and the many facets of how language begins and ends. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Now, linguists have looked before on the language of babies and early child years, but apparently not looked at language at the end of life before. Why do you think that is?
The main reason is that linguists and other language scientists are really trying to solve the problem of how much of what we bring to language is part of our kind of biological endowment, so the result of evolution, versus experience that an individual baby has once it's out in the world or even when it's still in the womb. So there doesn't leave a whole lot of room in that kind of in that kind of interest for what's going on at the very end of life, even though there are patterned phenomena that do happen at the end of life that are very interesting to look at.
So it's been fascinating for you then looking into this and trying to see the patterns that are there.
Yeah, it has been really interesting. So what we have in the West and in the English-speaking world is this and in other languages too, these traditions of like collecting famous last words, of individuals who say some idiosyncratic, unique thing, and sometimes it's witty, sometimes it's eloquent. But there are lots of other things that go on. So there are lots of things that happen that are not words at all. And if you talk to people who have been at the bedside of someone who is dying, they talk about, other kinds of things like gestures or what someone does with their eyes or facial expressions that are just as meaningful, as words. So there's that whole thing. And I write about that in the book. And the other thing that's interesting is, so the famous last word is an individual, utterance. No one has said it. No one will say it ever again. But there are lots of people, maybe even more people, who die with the expectation that they say a specific thing, often that's prescribed for them to say by their religion. So sometimes it's the name of a god, sometimes it's a prayer, sometimes it's a sacred sound or something like that. And I found that really interesting to look at too, and to put side to side with these individual words and say, which one did we do first, historically speaking, and we shifted to something else. Why did we shift? And maybe what are some of the drawbacks of the expectations that we have now?
It made me smile that the book is called Bye Bye, I Love You, because I think having been at the deathbed of various family members over time, I think it's a really, romanticized idea that we might get from TV or films that, you know, when our loved one dies, they say something meaningful like, bye bye, I love you. But the, but the reality often is, not always, of course, the reality is, as you said, it's not often like that. Sometimes there aren't really any significant last words at all, because it is all, you know, noises, and obviously the death process can take a certain amount of time. And yeah. And so often afterwards, it's kind of hard to think what their last words might have been, because it might have been a while after they said something before they then died.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I like the way that you put that. I think I wrote the book in some ways to present something of more closer to what's normal, so that people, you know, can change their expectations and don't walk away from that experience feeling like they missed out, or that, you know, that maybe even guilt or shame that they didn't get something that they were supposed to get. And on the title, what's funny is that this was a really hard book to title, actually. So what we hit on was actually combining some actual first words and some actual last words. So bye-bye is a very frequent first word, actually, for English-speaking babies, particularly top 10 most frequent first words. And I love you is, you know, an attested last word as well.
Yeah. So what did you find out? I know you've got the book in kind of in two halves, the first part looking more at first words and the last part looking at last words. So let's talk about first words. What did you find out? Were you surprised what you found out?
I was surprised by how I could kind of categorize responses to first words. So it was clear that, you know, that in some communities, a baby has to say a specific thing, just like the prescribed last words. So in order to be considered a human, like a member of the community, a baby has to say a specific thing. Then there are communities where, like, they're just waiting for a certain quality in the child's language. There's no specific form that the child is supposed to produce. And then there's kind of the attention, the very kind of intense attention that language scientists give to babies, including their own when they have them, that has kind of spread and become a feature of kind of middle class parenting in lots of places around the world, you know, where you're looking to make sure that the child is achieving certain kinds of milestones on the right schedule. The thing that people are surprised at most when I tell them about first words is that there are communities that actually don't care about first words, which doesn't mean that they're ignoring their babies or not using language with them. And in fact, those babies will become perfectly fluent speakers of their language. Sometimes the adults are looking for other kinds of milestones that are more social in nature and not specifically linguistic. So I think I was surprised at how those first words pattern like that. And I was surprised by people's surprise about that last category, that there are, like, doesn't it sort of make sense that there might be some people who don't care about those things? But I guess it wasn't.
But it is surprising, I think, that it's whole communities. It's just not, it's not like the odd person. What kind of communities then aren't bothered?
Well, they're typically communities that have to be engaged in, you know, lots of other activities, right? Like working outside. You know, it seems like they're kind of agriculture-based kinds of communities where the men and the women are working, right. And they're not spending time having a lot of face-to-face interaction with their infants.
And what about the communities that you said where they're expecting the baby to, the first words needs to be a certain kind of thing to do with religion or something, I guess. Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we are, you know, we belong to one of those communities, right, where the expectation is that the baby says mama or dada. And it used to be solely mama that babies, you know, were expected to say. There was a kind of psychoanalytic theorist who said, well, of course, you know, all babies say mama or papa. And then she evidently, while writing her essay, started asking around and found out, oh, that babies were saying all kinds of other things that were not mama and papa. And she had to revise her conclusions. But we seem to have shifted in first words, just like we've shifted in last words, from this kind of ritual form, all babies say mama. It's like, yeah, the same thing. It's not that interesting. To, oh, what does the individual baby have to tell us? Oh, helicopter or no, or something like that, that tells us something about the individual, you know, and who they're going to be in the future, because we won't necessarily be around to see that, or only a little bit of that. And we want to use anything we can get to see into the tunnel of that becoming.
Yeah. I suppose at the beginning of life, parents or some parents will feel a certain amount of pressure making sure that their baby is speaking at the right age. You know, they'll be referring to paperwork and graphs, or this is supposed to happen at this age, and, you know, make it. And if it doesn't happen with their child, then they might be concerned, you know, might even take it to the doctor because it hasn't said anything yet at the mm-hmm. time when it's expected to.
Yeah. So I have a chapter about an effort that was started, you know, in the late 1980s to try to determine the boundaries of what is sort of normal child development. If you've been a parent in lots of communities speaking lots of languages, because this test has spread all over the place brought your concerns to a doctor or a nurse or like a speech language pathologist and been told, yeah, that's normal. You've encountered this research that was done with, you know, thousands and thousands of babies to try to determine mainly vocabulary size and what is considered to be normal development. And it has quite a large range, you know, from like 50 words to 200 words, I forget the upper bound of that. But there is a, you know, so I think the significance of that is that any one child's first word or first words, you know, by itself really might not be that significant or interesting. I mean, they're kind of ordinary, ball, dog, bye-bye. But taken together as groups, they can really reveal something interesting about what babies are interested in, how babies are raised in different places, what they notice in different sorts of places, which is reflected in the typical first words that they speak. So part of the book was then to go, okay, well, what could we learn about groups of last words that we've kind of been shown a path for by looking at groups of first words.
Mm. Yeah, it makes sense with regards to the first word that it depends what the baby is being shown. And as you say, their living environment. So if it was dog or woof woof, I know is another popular one, you'd assume that there would be at least one dog in the house for that to be the case. And the parents are constantly saying, this is the dog. She goes woof woof and all that kind of thing to encourage the baby to make that noise. And at the same time, ball, you know, you'd assume that the one or two of the parents would be constantly saying, ball, ball, this is a ball. I mean,
right.
Repetition, I guess, is the key for a lot of first words for babies.
Yep. And then you get into the territory of, well, so the baby said something that was said to it. Is it is that repetition? Does that count as a word? You know, is that an individual production, or are they just, you know, mimicking? But a lot of the first words do have some interesting properties. So they rate very high in, you know, babiness. Like, they are things that have to do with babies, but that also babies can themselves sort of change or manipulate. So lots of babies, you know, have experiences with diapers, and they hear the word diaper constantly, but that doesn't show up as a first word very frequently. Similarly, you know, items of furniture apparently don't show up. So there's some element of, you know, babies are learning how to not just label things in their world, but they're learning to communicate. Like, they want to change their world and to have social interactions. So that's why they learn what they learn.
Yeah. And also at the beginning, those early years when they're saying what they think are the right words, but might be missing out letters. So instead of saying banana, they might say anana or something.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then the fun, and then the fun part as the parent is to go, what did they say? Was that this or was it this? And then there are lots of stories that you can get. Although I think the oldest child will have more stories told about him or her than younger children. But that's not the worst thing that can happen to you, you know, to not have anyone notice your first words.
And then was there any pattern that you found between people's first words and people's last words? Was there any connection there, or are they separate subjects, if you like?
I mean, they are separate subjects in the sense that what you say as a first word really doesn't have any bearing on, you know, what you say at the end. One parallel is that one of the first things that we learn how to do, or the babies learn how to do, is they learn how to take turns, right? The baby does something, a caregiver does something, a baby does something, so they go back and forth. And even at the end of life, even when people have lost the ability to speak and they're, you know, using hand squeezes or something like that, that structure remains, and that really is one of the last things to go. So I found a certain beauty in that it's not a return as much as it's not until you get to the very, very end that what's revealed is that very fundamental structure of interaction that had been there all along that we kind of took for granted.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier about expectations. I think that can kind of mar the situation, both from the point of at the beginning and also at the end. You know, if with your baby you're wanting and expecting it to say mama and it says dog, you know, you've got to not be disappointed. And at the same time, at the end, you know, the expectation that you get a proper goodbye or I love you, you've just got to let the process happen naturally, I suppose, and get rid of those expectations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's so true. One of the things that I didn't get into as much as I was able to was talking to parents of late talkers, and even talking to parents of like nonverbal kids. You know, how did they? I mean, it must be really difficult, you know, when you're part of a culture that is really prizing that first word, to not be on that same schedule, you know, as everyone. And then how do you celebrate? Do you celebrate that first thing if it ever comes? When do you get to celebrate it, and how do you do that? Maybe I'll have to write a sequel.
yeah.
And get into those other populations.
Yeah, interesting. So did you enjoy the process of writing this book? Did you find it as interesting as you hoped?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was highly, highly satisfying. I mean, also because at the outset I was pitching the book and saying, okay, this is a book about first words and last words, and encountering some agents and editors saying, no, we think it's two books. Why are you putting these two things together? And I'm like, I think it's one book. And so going through and writing and finding out just at every turn how, in fact, these two things do belong together, both from a language perspective and maybe a more philosophical perspective as well, that there's so much about one end of things that kind of gets illuminated when you look at it in terms of the other one. So that part was really enjoyable. And I learned a lot, you know, I learned a lot about what it is that babies do and the history of our attention to that. That was very gratifying. And then also really understanding what language at the end of life is like. I just now feel my own self personally more prepared, you know, for that, how I will be and what I'm going to encounter with my own loved ones.
Yeah. I wonder how over time the significance of those first and last words become less significant, you know, unless it's something absolutely amazing and groundbreaking. You know, at the time when your baby says their first words, it'll be exciting, whatever it is, if you're the kind of family or culture that wants to celebrate that. But, you know, if it was mama or woof woof or whatever, maybe 20, 30, 40 years later, you might not even remember that. And at the same time, the last words of a loved one, unless it was something really, really poignant and beautiful, I love you, thank you for everything you've done for me, or something like that, that you're not likely to forget because it's so beautiful, the likelihood is, you know, you are going to forget these things as life moves on, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Some of these things do have a tendency to live in stories and get retold in families, and the things that are very memorable, you know, are the ones that survive because they're fun stories or meaningful stories to tell, which is another reason I think why linguists have found the last words or language at the end of life harder to study, you know, because these are moments that are very personal, they are very intimate, and admitting observers into those scenes is very difficult, almost offensive. And so if you, after the fact, ask people, well, what happened? You know, did you hear anything? Did the person say anything or sign anything? That what tends to come out are the things that are really memorable. And I use the metaphor of rainbows, you know, to describe those things. Like, so rainbows are things that are quite beautiful. When they happen, we remember them, but they happen under a narrow set of conditions and not really all that often. But that what we encounter on a daily basis, and I live in the Netherlands, so it is a daily basis for me, is the rain, you know? And that's what we need to understand, to be able to plan for it and to know, you know, what's going to be expected of us. Mm-hmm. And so I've been, you know, the book is partly oriented towards, like, the rainbows are one thing, and that's extraordinary, but now let's focus on the rain.
Mm. Another thing which I've just thought of, because I've been with the regards to end of life, I've been picturing somebody, you know, being in their deathbed, you know, with everybody knowing the situation. But of course, then you have situations when people die in their sleep and, you know, nobody knew it was going to happen, or tragic accidents and things like that. And last words can be something like, don't forget to put the rubbish out, or something completely random and not significant at all, or God forbid, an argument, you know, which is why there's all thing, you know, don't fall asleep on an argument and try and make up with your loved ones just in case something awful was to happen, because the guilt would be too much to bear, you know.
Yeah, no, and why you say, I love you when you leave the house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
people.
Interesting. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Bye Bye, I Love You. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Michael Erard, who we've been chatting with today. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Hannah.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.